everybody in Chapel Hill seems to be reading and talking about Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, Tim Tyson's book, which is the subject of the Carolina Summer Reading Program. And so, in response to popular demand, we're running an earlier interview with Tim Tyson. Here it is. Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and I'm interested in Blood Doesn't Sign My Name by Tim Tyson, which has been selected as the summer reading program book for this coming summer. And so the question has to be, will this book about basically about racial tension in Oxford, North Carolina in the early 70s, and memoir of the Tim Tyson's family and growing up, will this book be as controversial as Approaching the Quran or Nickeled and Dimed? Well, Tim Tyson is with me to speak to that question. Let me just reframe the question. And what is your hope? You want this to be controversial, Tim Tyson?
I think if everyone listening today would go out and call Rush Limbaugh and tell him it's an outrage that this book has been selected and has to be stopped, I think that would be a great thing.
No. So an author.
No such thing as bad publicity, I think.
I guess that's right in terms of book sales, but I think your interest in this book, clearly it goes beyond the sale of books.
Well, I doubt, honestly, that I'm not sure that there's a safe political angle from which to grab this book. You know, I don't think it's an ideologically driven sort of book. And there's not a clean place in it to sit down, really. And we've all got something to learn, including me.
Well, I guess the thing to do, Tim Tyson, is to ask you to talk about your book and to tell us what it is about and what you sought to accomplish in your book.
It's really, in a specific way, it's about a murder that took place on May 11th, 1970, in Oxford, North Carolina. About 35 miles north of here, a little tobacco market town, about 8,000 people in 1970, where my father was a Methodist minister. And Gerald Teal, who was a boy that I played with almost every day, walked up in our driveway and said, "Daddy and Roger and them shot him a nigger." That's what he said. And he was talking about the fact that his father and his two older brother and stepbrother had butchered Henry Mara, who was 23, an African-American veteran who recently home from the Army, had two little girls and a third on the way, and had walked up in their store and was perceived to have made a flirtatious remark to a white woman and paid for that with his life, though I don't believe that he even did that. But, or at least there was a dispute on the scene about what had been said and who it had been said to. But anyway, he was unarmed and weighed 140 pounds. And the three of them set upon him and shot him in the buttocks. And he skidded onto his face in the gravel there, 200 feet or so off of their property. And they beat him with the shotgun and the rifle, broke the stock of the shotgun over his head, and then put the barrel of the rifle down on his forehead and pulled the trigger. Prosecutors said they killed him like you or I would kill a snake. And then I remember walking down to the corner of our street that evening and seeing Gerald's house with armed men all over the front porch.
This is your friend, your little friend,
yes,
who gave you the report. My first report
of this came from him. And then I saw the men with guns all over his front porch. The Ku Klux Klan had come and were protecting their house. The next morning, I walked to school with my sister Boo, and we saw all the plate glass windows in downtown Oxford were broken out. We'd had a big riot. There were 50 or so state troopers downtown with shotguns standing on every corner as we walked to school. There was a curfew for a week or so where people were not allowed to come and
this
go.
This is all from your memory as a 10-year-old.
Yes. Well, I remember these things. And then later, actually when I was a freshman at UNCG, I started researching it, and then went back to Oxford and interviewed Robert Teel at his barber shop to ask him why they had killed Henry Morrow.
And what did he say? Well, first of all, how'd you get him to talk? Why would he talk?
Well, he sort of wanted to talk but wouldn't talk. And then after he had declined to talk on the tape, I stayed in his barbershop and we just visited. And I just decided I would stay until I annoyed him and then I would leave. But I just wanted
to... So, I mean, were you getting a haircut? Did you get a haircut?
I got a haircut and hung around and talked about whatever he wanted to talk about. And he would occasionally talk about it off the record because he really wanted to talk about it, I think. And then my friend Gerald drove up. And I hadn't seen him since we were 12.
This was the friend who gave you this report that is the opening sentence of your book about about the killing.
So Gerald drove up, and then he said, "Tim Tyson, how you doing?" And we started visiting, and his dad realized that I was who I said I was and that I had been a neighbor of theirs. And I think the assumption was that because of my pigmentation and my accent that I was sympathetic to their position anyway. And then he turned on my tape recorder and said, and I quote, "That nigger committed suicide coming in my store wanting to four-letter word my daughter-in-law," unquote. And that was sort of the beginning of all this.
Well, you know, this is something, this is just my curiosity. But what Mr. Teel, the person who participated in the killing of Henry Morrow, was he a barber, a storekeeper, or both? Or
all
what?
Those things. He had a little strip mall, you would call it now, on the outskirts of Oxford, five businesses, a car wash and gas station and laundromat and a motorcycle shop and barber shop there in a little convenience grocery store. It was in a neighborhood called Graball, which was essentially a African-American section of town. Some parts of it tidy, middle-class homes, but a lot of it houses without any running water, old tenant houses.
So it was his service, was this shopping center serving both whites and blacks? Or
it was, but they didn't cut black people's hair or shine black people's shoes in the barbershop, but a lot of their business was selling groceries to people who walked to the store. And people who didn't have running water obviously didn't have washing machines, so the laundromat was there. His business was probably 80% black.
Well, but he had this, as you found out when you walked past his house that morning as a little boy and saw the Ku Klux Klan there protecting him, you realized he had connections to the white supremacy movement, I guess.
Yes, he did. He did. And why he decided to run a store in essentially a black ghetto, I can't tell you. But he had trouble the whole time that he was there. He had a whole string of violent incidents, some of them about race. He was known as a man who settled differences with his fists or with whatever weapon lay at hand. And he'd been arrested for about every violent crime you've ever heard of, if you look at his... record.
Well, now you did, as you mentioned earlier, you did a lot of research after, but all this is based fundamentally on the rock of your experience as a young, your memory
it's
as
rooted
a young...
in that. I started the first time I wrote this, I wrote it as my master's thesis. Well, I started writing it as a freshman paper at UNC Greensboro, but I did a lot of research and didn't write too much. But I came back to it and did my master's thesis on it, which you could read at the library, and if you could bear it, and you would not know that I lived there,
or you'd scholarized it. You'd made
I
and
did.
Been become
I did.
Objective.
I wanted to be a scholar and a historian, and I was earning my credentials and learning that craft. But in a certain way, I found that was a species of lie.
Because, why? Because I mean, it looks to me like that would be a very strong discipline way to get to approach it from a different angle.
It was a useful thing, but not something that I was capable of in the end, I think, and not something that, you know, to be a kind of witness to these events as they unfolded was a great gift and one that I didn't use. So, and also to pretend to be a detached scholar of something that actually shaped your whole life and that was such a passionate right. part of your development and your family's history was really
well, I'd want to
a little bit dishonest.
Yeah.
I think you're fundamentally right. It was well worth doing, and it gave me the vast store of objective factual information that right. undergirds and strengthens the book. But the power of the book may come from another place.
No, absolutely. Okay, I agree with that. We don't need to have an argument now. I was just going to say that.
I think we're on the same page.
That the book that is rooted in your personal experience, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, good is not a strong enough word, but is such a good book because it combines both the strong personal feeling that clearly runs through, but is also grounded in some factual experiences and in some factual research and digging that probably came from the scholarly work that you did on it. And so we don't have any argument. Let's take a break, though, and come back and talk about what our listeners will probably be more interested in, and that is the story about what really happened in Oxford on that day that your – or the day before your friend came and reported to you what had happened.
All right.
And now, here's Deborah Miller from A Southern Season.
From our legendary Tar Heels to our incomparable quality of life, our hometown pride is evident at every turn. Named one of America's outstanding retailers at the International Fancy Food Show, we're bursting at the seams with award-winning gifts of good taste, glorious flavors, and gustatory delights. Our family of customers extends far and wide, but we wouldn't even think of calling anywhere else home.
A Southern Season, Chapel Hill's landmark gourmet emporium at University Mall.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. My guest is Tim Tyson, who's the author of Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, which has been selected by the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill as the book for this summer's reading program. Tim Tyson, you were telling us the story of this book. First of all, you told us about your personal experience as a 10-year-old having learned of the death of an African-American person, and then waking up the next morning and walking through town and finding the windows broken out and highway patrolmen all over. That was your experience as a little boy. As you researched it, what had happened?
This young black man had walked up in front of Robert Teal's store, where Teal's son Larry Teal and daughter-in-law Judy were uncrating a motorcycle. He made a remark of a flirtatious or sexual nature. Larry picked up a 2x2 and swung at him, saying, "That's my wife you're talking to." He said, "I was talking to the sisters." He said he was flirting with these two young black women who were also near the front of the store. So there was a dispute right there about that. Larry would have none of it, had a hot temper by all accounts, and went after him with this 2x2. Henry Mara threw a handful of gravel up in his face from the parking lot to give himself a little room to run, and ran a couple of hundred feet off the property. By that time, Robert Teal and Roger Oakley, who was Teal's stepson, had entered the fray, had gone inside the store, gotten a shotgun and a rifle. Teal shot him in the buttocks with a shotgun, knocking him onto his face.
This was the daddy, Mr. Teal.
Yes. Larry was 18 and Roger was 21. Their daddy was about 40. He's really in charge of the killing, though. Who actually pulled the trigger and fired the fatal shot is a matter of some dispute. But the truth of the matter is, the three of them set upon him to kill him. They bashed in his head very badly with a shot. They broke a shotgun stock over his head. If you can imagine hitting somebody hard enough with a shotgun to break the stock, which would be pretty hard to do. But, you know, so they were intending to kill him. I mean, they you can't hit somebody in the head with a shotgun stock over and over again that hard without intending or at least being willing for them to die. And then when he was really semi-conscious and had two very bad skull fractures, a bullet was fired through his brain with the barrel of the gun on his touching his forehead. So it was a brutal act and an unnecessary thing.
Let me just ask you, after the killing, the other thing that you experienced as a young boy was the damage that was done that evening in downtown Oxford. And I wonder if what had happened? Why did that happen, and who did it, and was it planned or spontaneous?
Well, this is 1970, and you have to remember, the whole country is on fire. Dr. Martin Luther King has been dead for 2 years, and nonviolence as a way of going at the civil rights movement was over, and young blacks assumed that white people controlled the legal system and that these fellows would go free, as they did. They also there was also a problem with the arrest. The Teals really weren't arrested for a couple of days after this killing, and they were sort of allowed to turn themselves in at their leisure. And they had a very powerful local attorney, Billy Watkins, who was a legislator. And the country club folks and the courthouse gang rallied around the Teals and raised lots of money for their defense. So they really had access to the privileges of the white and wealthy. And but now, young blacks rioted.
The riot, though, took place before any of this became it was immediate, wasn't it?
There was a riot immediately. Then there was a big protest movement that grew up. Young Ben Chavis, now Benjamin Chavis Muhammad, was 23 and teaching at the local high school, and he became the leading spokesperson for a movement of some thousands of African-Americans in Granville County and eastern North Carolina generally that marched to Raleigh and had the demonstrations and this sort of thing. Inside of that movement, was a cluster of black Vietnam veterans who, I don't know if we can say what they said on the radio, but anyway. We weren't into that Martin Luther King shit. And what they decided.
It interests me because Henry Morrow himself was a veteran.
Yes.
And one
of their number had been killed.
These young African-American veterans, have all kinds of things that set them apart from other, I don't want to say ordinary blacks, but just from other people. Right. One is that they're black. One is that they've been radicalized in some respects, by the Vietnam experience. And the other is that one of them, not just another black, but one of them has been killed. So while they may not have been, this is all a question, while they may not have been themselves all that into civil rights initially, when somebody in your family gets taken, then you, but that's what I want, that's the story I kind of want you to tell, is the story of these young men and what they were doing and how quickly they got started and.
Well, during that, they got started pretty quickly. Some of them were in the riot, and then as the weeks wore on.
Let me just interrupt you again, Tim. But sure. What do you mean the riot? What was the riot? This immediate riot.
A couple of hundred young blacks, mostly, ran through the streets of downtown Oxford, broke all the windows, firebombed a couple of buildings, tried to pull the Confederate monument down. ravaged a grocery store, that sort of thing. And they rioted. They turned over a police car. Somebody shot at the chief of police and the mayor, who were sitting in another police car. And they pretty much controlled the streets of Oxford for 6 hours or so in the wee hours.
This was in the immediate aftermath of the murder.
Yes. And then we didn't have another riot like that. After that, we had protest movement, demonstrations and marches, and we had an arson campaign. There were about 40 firebombings in Oxford. Oxford's a tobacco market town, and they burned the warehouses. And this was, as one of them told me, a military operation. They had military skills that they had learned.
So you were, just to get back to your book, in your research, you went back and talked to these people who are roughly not your age contemporaries, a little bit older than you are, but now you're you know, you all so in on my, the same. Yes. You can talk to him.
When I was in my 20s and they were in their 40s, I started talking to them. And I fell in with really one of their ringleaders who just took me from one to the other and said, you know, this is Tim. He's working with me. Tell him the story. And so because of that, I had access to them.
Well, you deal very specifically and as a central part of your book with the failure of the justice system to convict the people who were responsible for the killing of Henry Mora. Maybe you're a little bit more gentle with the failure of the justice system to bring some of these rioters to justice for the crimes that they committed. That sounds like a that's a question.
Yeah.
But
I hold these things in a different scale.
Uh-huh. Well, of course they're a different scale. But is the,
for one thing, they didn't kill anybody. And of course, in politics, everybody thinks they're moderate, right? But they felt that they were taking a moderate, measured stand. They were destroying property that was worth money. One of them said it was like we had a cash register down at the pool hall just ringing up how much money we cost the white people. We knew if we cost them enough money, things would change. So it was really an economic and political calculus that they were doing. And they felt like the white people had killed one of them, and all they were doing was burning some business property. So they really felt that it wasn't tit for tat and eye for an eye. Eye for an eye would have been to go kill Robert Teel, for example. And they didn't do that.
Let's take a break. I'm going to come back and ask you whether or not those decisions about how to approach the rioting and the property destruction you think were sort of calculated, deliberate, or whether that was an emotional response. And I'll ask you that after we come back from the short break. I'm talking to Tim Tyson, who's the author. Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, the selection for the Carolina Summer Reading Program this year.
This is Roy Williams. Building a successful basketball program requires teamwork, discipline, and intelligent players. We are proud of these qualities in our team, just as I'm proud of our university's support for what we think is the best community bus system in the country, where the rides are all free. Just as we enjoy playing together, we can also enjoy the people we meet who ride together, who save time, gas money, parking hassles, and remove cars from the road. At Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and UNC, their buses are for everyone, and the buses here are free.
You've been noticing the signs for a while. Roughness, wrinkling, irregular pigmentation, or inelasticity. These are all normal changes in our skin as we age. This is Dr. Lori Etter of Central Dermatology. As we grow older, our skin doesn't produce new cells at the same pace. Here are several tips to enhance skin care as you grow older. Use skincare products that nourish your skin cells, such as creams and lotions with ingredients like vitamin B complex, copper, and flax oil. If you smoke, stop. Ask your doctor or skincare specialist about other topical products that can help maintain and protect your skin's health.
For medical or cosmetic questions about your skin, call Central Dermatology Center at 401-1994 or click on www.cdcskin.com. Central Dermatology is located on Highway 54 near the I-40 Exchange. Central Dermatology, protecting what protects you.
Time is on my side. Yes, it is.
Sturtevant's Tire and Auto will help get time on your side. Sturtevant's Tire and Auto is now an official North Carolina inspection station. And that's not it. They're also taking appointments. You can make an appointment today at Sturtevant's for your inspection as well as other repair and maintenance needs. So whether it's tires, automotive repairs, scheduled maintenance, or to get your car inspected, you can rely on Sturtevant's Tire and Auto. Sturtevant's is on Highway 54 West. Call 942-TIRE. That's 942-TIRE.
You can hear D.G. Martin with a replay of Who's Talking from the whole week, Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360, WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Tim Tyson, author of the summer reading program for this, the Carolina Summer Reading Program selection for this year, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, about the events in Oxford after a 1970 racial murder and the subsequent riots and property damage and trial and everything that Tim Tyson and you bring together so well. One of the puzzle for me in your book is your description, and I'd say a sympathetic description, of the actions that were taken by the African-American community after the murder and the property destruction that was a part of it. And you said that it was just a cash register kind of thing. They were calculating the value of the damage to property that they did, understanding that when the damage became so great, then maybe things would change. And my question for you is, were they really doing this calculation, or were they reflecting back years later, trying to put a framework on what they were just doing kind of intuitively?
Well, they were angry for sure. And it was, Martin Luther King said, a riot is the language of the unheard. And I believe that, the Raleigh News and Observer had an editorial about the arson and the rioting, saying, nothing could be more fruitless than violence in the streets. But I would ask them back, nothing changed. No one was willing to consider changing anything in Oxford, North Carolina, until the building started burning and the bullets started flying. And I would like to say, I'm not in favor of violence. I think violence leaves lasting breaches between people. And so it's not a good thing. But if you won't hear the voices of people who are in the streets pleading, you're going to hear something else. And I think that's there's not a clean and innocent place in this story. Nobody has done some kind of morally pristine kind of thing. It's politics and among human beings.
Well, this is why I think your book is going to be, maybe if people focus on this point, your book is going to be more controversial than maybe the selection committee had in mind.
Yeah.
Of course it should be controversial, because anytime you look at history, it ought to be controversial. It's not.
Yeah, it's not a matter of public debate.
Yeah, it is. But that's a point maybe we can talk about in a little bit. But right in the middle of our country's war on terrorism, where we really say any act of terrorism against property or persons, we're primarily against people, of course, but property, person, the damage, we're against people who do that kind of thing, whatever their motives or whatever their ultimate objectives are. We're in a war on terrorism. And so here you are in this book saying, we wouldn't have, we can, it, this is what I think you're saying. I want you to correct me. Yeah. This is what I think you're saying. It's all fine, well, and good to talk about the civil rights movement as a nonviolent movement. But if there hadn't been the accompanying violence, the progress wouldn't have been made, because nonviolence wouldn't have had any meaning if it weren't for the, and if I misread you in that.
I don't have any argument about what you said. I would say, though, that we have a kind of a sanitized cartoon about the civil rights movement. We forget that in Birmingham in 1963, while Martin Luther King, on the one hand, was marching in the streets with black children and into the faces of the police dogs and the fire hoses, and we think of that as being just pure good versus pure evil, and violence versus nonviolence. In fact, in Birmingham, blacks took to the streets. 9 blocks of Birmingham were destroyed in a riot. The Kennedy administration, John F. Kennedy, went on television and proposed a new Civil Rights Act on June 11th, 1963, because his advisors and people on the ground in Birmingham thought there would probably be a local race war. There was all manner of violence in Birmingham. And Dr. King didn't approve of violence, but he went places and incited it. He incited violence upon the demonstrators. But, there was always that other march, people throwing those nonviolent rocks and bottles at the police. He went places and created mayhem and turned what he called creative tension. But it wasn't, a morally pristine kind of process. And it had to do with coercion and making people do what they knew was right. It wasn't enough to try to morally persuade people. but in fact, it was politics, which...
Well, it's clear that you have great sympathy with the people, or with the young African-American group of people who were responsible for this property damage and burning down the warehouses.
I don't approve of everything they did.
I didn't say approve. I say have sympathy.
I'm sure I have sympathy for it.
But as a historian, I don't want to call you a revisionist or anything, but there is this image of civil rights history that you were just describing that your book forces us to see the, I don't want to call it the dark side, the underside, the parts of this progress that, you know, we're glad about the result, but we're not proud. We don't necessarily have to be proud of how we got here.
Yeah. Well, if a careful sifting of the facts about the civil rights movement revealed this pure nonviolent approach to things, I would write about that. But in fact, that's not what we've been through as a nation. You know, and the process we actually went through was much more painful. In 1963, when Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream," most Americans told pollsters a few days later that they thought the civil rights movement had already gone too far and too fast. And that is before we had a Civil Rights Act, so we had segregation. It was before we had a Voting Rights Act, so the voting rights of African Americans in the South were not insured. And most places they could not vote. And yet, white people said it's gone too far and too fast. Now, on Martin Luther King Day, you'd think that everybody loved Martin Luther King, but in fact, students at Duke were uncorking champagne when Martin Luther King was assassinated. Martin Luther King was not a candidate for president, and people espousing his views were pretty much ineligible for public office during this entire period. So the problem is that the history that people think I'm revising didn't happen.
Well, that's the revisionist historians are always finding new facts. And
I'm not really outside the mainstream, honestly, among historians. Well, this book will hold, you know, historians like it. And I've gotten a lot of nice mail from my colleagues in the history profession. But it's not necessarily busting down a whole lot of
paradigms. But here's what I would say for those of us who are amateur historians or just citizens who are a part and product. It's amazing because some of us who were part of the generation of people who thought we'd gone too far and who were not all that unhappy about Dr. King's death, as that generation now, they're just right on the bandwagon when we have the Martin Luther King Day celebration.
Yeah,
they're in the choir. They're in the choir. And we've amazingly, we haven't had to wait two, three, four generations. We have reconstituted our way of looking at things among individuals who are still alive.
Yes.
You know, I mean, of course, it's not as strong. The second and third generations it's even stronger. But there's this civic view of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement that is akin, I suppose, to our mythology about Thanksgiving and sitting down with the Indians and having a meal. That is what we really want to believe. But, you know, you revisionist historians will tell us it doesn't comport with the facts.
Well, we've been through a painful breach. It's not all bad. I think it, in some ways that those misconceptions and sort of rosy view that we like to put together about the civil rights movement reflect a commendable desire to live together in a better way. And yet, it's just like going to your psychiatrist and telling her that you've always done the right thing and been a shining exemplar, you know, and yet that's not really going to get you anywhere, is it? You know, we all need to have an honest confrontation with our actual past, I think. And if we want to mend the scars of race and our history of slavery and segregation, if we want to and be one nation, as I think most of us want to do, we have to look our actual history squarely in the eye and reconcile with each other, and not just tell ourselves a story that we'd prefer had happened.
Well, there is this great quote, and I can't find it, but it's something that you say that you have to face your history like you're a runaway slave.
And
in order to really deal with it, you have to face up to the chasing hound dogs before you can really be free, or something like that.
I think I said we're all runaway slaves from our own past. You know, we all wish things were different, but we can't escape the hounds unless we turn and face them. You know, that these things will follow us until we confront them. And when we do, it's not so bad. You know, I've been up in Oxford lately. You know, this was a terribly controversial event at the time, and all these things were very hard for Oxford as a community. But I was up at the high school, and 500 people came out and ate fried chicken, about half black and half white, and talked about all these things. And people are reading the book together in Granville County. Some people don't like it. People, of course, dispute this and that. But it's given people a common thing to talk about. And there are very fruitful conversations going on between black people and white people in Oxford and Granville County. And I think one thing I would say about Oxford is that though it has a harder history than some places, it's not so much harder than the history of, you know, you can pretty much put your finger on the map anywhere in the country and find this story at a time and place. And yet, not everybody's willing to talk about it.
Yeah, they're doing that. Right.
I think it's really important what they're doing.
Very important point that you've made in your books and your conversations after the book, that I want to be sure I got it clear. Yeah. And that Oxford is not that atypical. It's not an atypical. This might have been a little bit louder than some places in North Carolina, but what I think you're seeing is you put your finger on any small town in North Carolina, you're going to find some things like this.
Yes.
And do you really mean that? Was it really?
Yeah, I do. And in fact, not just North Carolina, but America. The civil rights movement in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You know, I'm teaching at the University of Wisconsin these days.
I think
it was.
Let me just interrupt
yes.
you. Just I haven't mentioned this, and it's just a failing. We were talking about you as the author of this wonderful book, but you are a PhD and a professor of African American history at the University of Wisconsin, currently at the National Humanities Center on 1 year leave to do some more scholarly work. But we've been talking about you just like you're an ordinary author. You're not. You're a professor of African American history, and you got the scholarly look that helps. Contain, I guess, the strong feelings that you have about this experience. But let me push you on this. I mean, I can go to any small town. I won't necessarily find a racial murder. I won't necessarily find burnings.
I don't know of one without one.
Is that right?
I'm sure there is.
But you would say typically our small towns, if you look at the history, you could find a story like Blood Doesn't Sign My Name,
yeah,
and write about it if you looked at it.
There was a riot practically everywhere in the United States on April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King died. I think you could probably see the United States from outer space. The country was on fire. Mm. One reason people say to me, this story is so dramatic. How is it that I didn't hear about it? And they think they're woefully ignorant and ill-informed. Right. And I have to say, you didn't hear about it because it was on page 6B. I mean, it was on the front page of the News and Observer, but of the New York Times, you have to understand, Cleveland's on fire. Augusta, Georgia's on fire. I mean, the whole country is boiling. This happens. The Kent State killings were a few days before this. Jackson State, a few days after that, with police firing on the crowds and killing students. Down in Augusta, Lester Maddox sent the state troopers in there with buckshot and fired into crowds after a young boy had been murdered by the police in jail. And the police had tried to say he had fallen out of the bunk. And then when the coroner did the report, he apparently had fallen out of the bunk 100 or 200 times, you know, onto burning cigarettes. I mean, he'd been tortured to death in the jail. And the police lied about it. So people took to the streets and they fired on the crowds and killed 6 people that day. This was, you know, things like this were happening all over. The Weather Underground had bombed a police station in New York City and another in San Francisco. There were, the mobilization against the Vietnam War had put a couple of million people in the streets of America. It was a rough time. Mm. And so this thing is not an American story. It's a typical.
Listen, we're almost ready to run out of time. I couldn't stop. We do have to take a break. I'm talking to Tim Tyson, author of Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, the new selection for the Carolina Summer Reading Program. And Tim, when we come back, let's talk some about your family.
Sure.
You seem to worship your daddy. And be willing to put him in the perspective of the times, and I'd like to talk about that.
Hi, I'm Andy Woodhouse, pastor at Amity United Methodist Church at the corner of Estes Drive and Martin Luther King Boulevard. I'd like to invite you to join us for worship on Sunday mornings at our contemporary service at 9 a.m. or our traditional service at 11 a.m. and Sunday school for all ages at 10. We also have a number of small groups meeting throughout the week, as well as programs for children and youth. For more information on Amity, please visit our website at amityumc.org. I hope to see you and your family really soon.
Hello, what can I get you?
Ever wonder what you could buy for less than $3?
One small popcorn, please.
For about $3, you can buy one small popcorn at the movies or enough electricity to run your entire home for a day. But if you prefer the popcorn, consider this. For less than $3, you can buy enough electricity to pop 411 bags of popcorn. That's a lot of popcorn. By operating our electric system safely and efficiently, Duke Power is able to provide the reliable electric service you need. And with our diverse mix of fuel sources, we're able to maintain the affordable prices you want. So whether you're keeping your home safe and comfortable, cooking, refrigerating, washing, drying, vacuuming, using your computer, watching TV, or just popping lots of popcorn, electricity from Duke Power is affordable, safe, and reliable. Reliable service, affordable price, good value. That's our commitment to you. Learn more at www.dukepower.com.
WCHL 1360. Time now for Biography for Radio with Jack Perkins. Brought to you locally by the Cedars and East-West Partners community.
Suddenly, her husband was no longer in the spotlight. The hard gaze of the public turned on her. Her story next on Biography for Radio.
Oh, man, look at this.
What now?
They're raising my cable rates. If my long-distance rates go up, I just switch my phone service. But cable companies don't have any competition, so I'm stuck paying these rates.
But they do have competition. I called American Satellite and ordered a free four-room DirecTV system, and I love it. Call and ask how you can get access to over 225 channels, often for less money than what you pay for cable.
Call 888-999-0713. 888-999-0713. Hurry, offer ends February 28, 2006.
There was little room for weakness in her early life in Chicago. Her Methodist father was a former Navy drill instructor, and at home, he ran a tight ship. When she got a report card with all A's, he said, "It must be an easy school." It wasn't. She met her husband in the library at Yale. Upon graduation, he pursued politics in Arkansas. She worked as a lawyer. In 1992, her husband got his dream job. But it was whispered that the real brains in the family belonged to his wife. Ambitious, energetic, and sometimes hot-tempered, she pursued an idealistic agenda and for years enjoyed a position of power. Then, in the mid-1990s, the roof fell in. First, there were accusations of fraud in the Whitewater scandal. These were dropped. Then, in 1998, the president was impeached for misleading the public about his affair with Monica Lewinsky. His humiliated wife stood by him. In 2000, the former First Lady won a seat in the Senate. All eyes are now on 2008, when there just may be a presidential bid by Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton. For Biography, I'm Lawrence Scott.
Biography is a trademark of A&D.
Biography for Radio, brought to you on WCHL by the Cedars of Chapel Hill and East West Partners Community. The Cedars is the country's premier retirement community. Call 929-1995 to find out more on this very special community. Life has been good to you. Now it gets even better at the Cedars of Chapel Hill.
Who's Talking with D.G. Martin can be heard once again Sunday mornings on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Everybody in Chapel Hill seems to be reading and talking about Blood Doesn't Sign My Name, Tim Tyson's book, which is the subject of the Carolina Summer Reading Program. And so, in response to popular demand, we're running an earlier interview with Tim Tyson. Here it is.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. I'm talking to Tim Tyson, author of Blood Done Signed My Name. And Tim, of course, is a professor of African American history at the University of Wisconsin. He's down here with us this year, this school year, at the National Humanities Center. Tim, thanks for taking time to.
Well, thanks, DG. It's great to be here with you.
I'd like to continue to talk about your book. It just is provocative. That's all I can say about it. And if folks think it's not going to be controversial, they're going to be surprised when people read it. They're going to be like, it's just going to be so much to talk about and so much to argue about. And I think for that reason, it's going to be a learning experience. But some of the most beautiful parts of your book are your descriptions of your family. And I can tell you my reaction to it, but man, you love your parents, don't you?
Well, I've been very blessed. My parents, I was the son of a Methodist minister and a public school teacher in the civil rights era when the integration came and all these troubles. And I watched them really stand up for what was right. And I also saw their limitations and stuff, it made a great impression on me. My parents were wise and loving and courageous, and my father, who I don't, regard as a flawless saint or anything, but I did see him really put his chips on the line. He was willing to put his career and his livelihood and his life on the line, really just trying to do the right thing.
Yeah. The word in Oxford sort of was after your father took a role in sorting out the events after the murder and the riots in Oxford, got him, in the words of some people, run off. Bishop,
yeah.
Methodist ministers used to get run off every 4 years anyway, whether they were doing a good job or not. But the other thing, and we just got a minute, this was before y'all even came to Oxford. You described the occasion in which your father, without thinking about it too much, invited Dr. Samuel Proctor to come down and fill his pulpit in Sanford. And this was in the late 60s.
Yeah, well, I believe it was 64, the spring
the
mid-60s. 64 when he came. Yeah.
And Sam Proctor, I mean, man, if you could get
a
Sam
great
Proctor
preacher,
to come,
right.
Everybody.
I think Harvard paid him about $40,000 to give a commencement speech.
Yeah, but your daddy got him to come for free and just about divided the church up back in those days.
Really the greatest preacher of his generation, I think, Samuel Proctor.
I guess since we're out of time, I have to summarize. Let me just tell you what I thought about that, and that was that it puts now we can't
at home, at work, in the car. News Talk 1360 WCHL, Chapel Hill, Carrboro's News Talk and Tar Heel Station.